Lawmakers are demanding answers in the death of 7-year-old Jacqueline Amey Rosemary Caal Maquin. Jacqueline was a Guatemalan migrant who died in a Texas hospital last Friday, reportedly from dehydration, shock, and liver failure. She was in the custody of U.S. Customs and Border Protection. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we begin today on The Takeaway. 7-year-old Jacqueline is just one of more than 250 people who have died trying to cross the U.S. southern border this year. But exactly how Jacqueline died and who is responsible for her death is in dispute. The Department of Homeland Security says Jacqueline had not eaten or had water for several days before she and her father were taken into custody. On Fox and Friends, DHS Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen called the incident heart-wrenching, but she also repeated the government's long-standing argument that migrants should not attempt to reach the border through the desert.
You know, this is just a very sad example of the dangers of this journey. This family chose to cross illegally. We gave immediate care. We'll continue to look into the situation, but again, I cannot stress how dangerous this journey is when migrants choose to come here illegally.
A statement from Jacqueline's father paints a different picture of what unfolded. Ruben Garcia is the executive director of Annunciation House in El Paso, the shelter where the father is staying, and he spoke on the father's behalf.
Jacqueline's father took care of Jacqueline, made sure she was fed and had sufficient water. Jacqueline and her father speak Quiche, and Spanish is their second language. Yet CBP is relying on forms signed by her father, which are in English language. It is unacceptable for any government agency to have persons in custody sign documents in a language that they clearly do not understand.
And now lawmakers want answers. Senator Tom Udall is a Democratic senator from New Mexico, and he's one of a group of lawmakers who have called for a full investigation into Jacqueline's death. And he joins us now. Senator Udall, thanks so much for being with us.
You bet. Great to be with you, Tanzina.
So, Senator, when you first heard about the death of 7-year-old Jacqueline, who was in the custody of Customs and Border Protection, what were your immediate thoughts?
Well, like so many people across the country, I'm heartbroken by the death of Jacqueline and deeply concerned about what this says about the current state of our country. And as you said, I'm demanding an investigation from the Border Patrol and from the Inspector General of the DHS Department.
And of course, Senator, according to an unclassified government document that was obtained by ABC News, there are 281 people have died along the border during 2018. And since October, 32 more have died, including Jacqueline. Can you tell us about the conditions on the border, specifically in New Mexico, for migrants who may be crossing?
Well, it's very difficult country. You would not want to go. It's a desert. You would not want to go out unless you're prepared in this kind of area. And that's, you know, that's the kind of area we're looking at.
And, Senator, we've also seen videos and documented evidence of U.S. Border Patrol systems basically destroying water supplies that have been left in the desert for migrants. Can you give us a sense, as senator for one of these border states, what can be done? Have you been able to assess whether or not this is happening in your state? And if so, what's happening?
Yeah, I don't know whether that's happening in New Mexico, but I think it's very important for DHS in this full investigation to tell us what they're going to do to prevent this from happening again. This looks to me like, and this is what the Inspector General said that looked at this situation for the DHS Department, they said turning away asylum seekers at international bridges and ports may be causing an increase in these dangerous crossing attempts that are being made by Jacqueline, her family, and other migrants. See, what's happening is at the big ports of entry, for example, in El Paso, if anybody's been to the bridge down there, people try to cross, they're turned back. The customs people call this managing the queue. They only have room for a few people, so they don't let anybody in, so they turn people away. So then, rather than present themselves in an orderly way, they are forced to cross in these desert crossings under very dangerous circumstances. So they need to really change the policy here in terms of how they deal with asylum seekers. The courts are backlogged. We need to try to get adequate courts to make sure that asylum seekers get their cases heard. I mean, this is a single focus by this administration on building a border wall is not dealing with the real issues.
Senator, I'm curious. I just mentioned some of the data that came from this government report that ABC News was able to obtain of the number of people who have died just in 2018 alone. That's 281. What happens when there is a death at the border, Senator? Are law enforcement officials made aware of this? And we can talk a little bit about who's responsible for that in a minute.
Sure. My understanding is when there's a death, the Border Patrol takes control of the body, and then it's turned over to the authorities, and they make a determination on cause of death. As you say, there are many of these going on. They've reached a high of close to 500, then they come down to 200, depending on the year. We could change these policies to make this so that people that are seeking asylum, where they're in danger, they're in fear in their home country, they want to come to the United States to seek asylum, there should be an orderly process to do that. They shouldn't have to go out into the middle of the desert and put themselves in danger. That's international law. It's our law. Asylum seekers should be treated fairly.
Senator, the administration's narrative so far in terms of explaining Jacqueline's death has been that the conditions in which they traveled were to blame for her death. We heard similar remarks from DHS Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen. And I want to play you some calls from our audience here.
My name is Laura. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. I do believe that Congress should act on our immigration issue. The minute that they picked up the child that died, they became responsible for the welfare and safety of that child.
Hi, Kenneth Knott calling from Perkiomenville, PA. I think there should be a more proper assessment of the incoming detainees. This just shouldn't happen. I don't believe that she probably arrived in good condition.
Senator, those are two callers there basically asking, on the one hand, really, who is responsible for the welfare and safety of these migrants?
I totally agree with those two comments. We need to gather all the facts. You know, nothing has really been quoted about what the father had to say. That's why I'm demanding a full investigation, and a number of members of Congress from Texas and New Mexico have joined me. But we have to look at this in the broader context of the Trump administration's anti-immigrant policies. Policies have consequences, sometimes devastating, tragic consequences, and that's what we're seeing here. And then the other thing that I would recommend, we should look in a broader way. We should have a vision. We should rekindle President Kennedy's vision of an alliance for progress with our neighbors in Central and South America. These three countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, they have poverty, instability, violence. People are fleeing these countries. When you have an America First policy, you don't worry about other countries. But we're in this together with our neighbors in Latin America and Central America, and we should be working to do everything we can on the root causes that are there.
Senator, as the senator and representative of the state where Jacqueline died, are there specific steps that you would like to take to not just hold CBP accountable for their actions, but to improve the conditions across your state for migrants and asylum seekers?
Yes. Well, I think I've talked enough about the asylum seeker part of it, but I think there are also resource issues. I'm not convinced that the Customs and Border Patrol has on-the-ground resources, that they have the training or the appropriate coordination to ensure the safety of families. And so they need to evaluate this from top to bottom, tell us what they need. I'm on the Appropriations Committee. I'm willing to help with the resources, But I think blaming this all on the families and saying it's their fault, I don't think that that's the reality of the situation here.
Senator Tom Udall is a Democratic senator representing New Mexico. Senator Udall, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Real pleasure.
Hi, this is John from Grosse Pointe Park, Michigan. I think there should be a response from Congress concerning the Customs and Border Protection custody issues. I think we need transparency concerning how people are treated crossing the border. We really need advocates or witnesses to be present whenever people are being held.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection has frequently been accused of violating the human rights of those seeking asylum in the United States, especially in recent years. The administration had already drawn scrutiny for its recent handling of the migrant caravan at the U.S.-Mexico border near Tijuana. But according to a report from the ACLU and the University of Chicago School of Law, the CBP has had a long culture of child abuse and neglect. Joining me now is Claudia Flores, director of the International Human Rights Clinic at the University of Chicago School of Law. Claudia, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
So when we talk about this long culture of child abuse and neglect within the organization, within the CBP, what do we mean?
The University of Chicago International Human Rights Clinic and the ACLU received documents regarding investigations that had been conducted of child abuse of children within CBP custody during the Obama administration. So this is 2009 to 2014. And after reviewing those documents, found numerous instances and patterns of child abuse and also ineffective investigations of the supervisory mechanisms.
And in a statement released after Jacqueline's death, the Customs and Border Protection said that Jacqueline had reportedly not eaten or consumed water for several days. Her father rejects that claim and said she had been eating and drinking water. Regardless of the circumstances that led up to their crossing, when a Border Patrol agent detains someone at the border, particularly a child, what is the protocol?
Well, the protocol under the Flores settlement, which now is being altered by this temporary rule that has been issued by DHS, was to ensure the basic health care of children. So that's actually an obligation that the U.S. has both under domestic law and international human rights principles. That means if a child is sick, they receive immediate care, they receive immediate food, water, and basic standard of detention.
Now, of course, DHS is saying, and Kirstjen Nielsen specifically has said that this child, that Jacqueline did receive attention, that they did handle her situation as best as they could. However, would you agree? I mean, is there something else that, is there a limit to the amount of time? Are there more guidelines in terms of how quickly and how severe these cases should be handled?
Well, clearly what is occurring within CBP right now isn't working. There are numerous complaints, both in the public media and also in internal documentation, of inadequate care. Border Patrol in particular seems to be a fairly mismanaged organization. Research has been done on the high proportion of disciplinary proceedings and terminations within Border Patrol. The supervisory agencies terminate investigations based on ineffective and insufficient evidence because Border Patrol accounts counteract what the complaint said. So there is a need to really engage in some internal reform. And clearly, children are not being treated within basic standards.
We've been seeing a large numbers of people who have been stuck at ports of entry, particularly given some of the confusion around the Trump administration's policies on who can and can't enter. CBP officials say that they're only taking in a few people per day. That's sort of forcing folks to go and find other ports of entry. How did that contribute in any way to Jacqueline's death?
I don't know the specifics of how Jacqueline found herself in that situation, but the fact is that, as Senator Udall was just mentioning, a tight border approach to immigration is simply just ineffective. Any research that has been done on this issue has not found a correlation between deterring immigration and a tight border approach. There are a number of factors that are leading people to try to come to this country, and we need to address those factors first.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the CBP specifically. Did your report look at, your report looked obviously at the years 2009 to 2014 under the Obama administration. Did your report give any insight into how we could move forward under this new administration and beyond?
Absolutely. So we had a number of reflections and recommendations. One was really realigning and restructuring internal investigations of Border Patrol mismanagement and Border Patrol inaction. So there is really a need for better supervisory mechanisms, better internal investigation, a higher number of agents that conduct internal investigations. And then beyond that, really reexamine the detention policy. This is a high-cost policy for the United States that is not effective and is inhumane.
Claudia Flores is an associate professor at the University of Chicago School of Law. Claudia, thanks so much.
Happy to be here.
And we did reach out to Customs and Border Protection for comment on this story, but have not heard back yet. In the global conversation about the war in Yemen, there's one set of voices that's been notably absent, those of Yemenis themselves.
Our lives have been destroyed, but we are still alive. We live without hope, and we watch as human values loses their meanings. Democracy, human rights, equality, justice, these words and others have become, in our view, an absurd propaganda, as ridiculous as describing Mohammed bin Salman as a reformer.
That's Hussam al-Sanabani, and he's one of over 900 people who responded to a call on Twitter to describe what life is like in the war-torn country. Shireen Al-Adimi was behind that initial call. She left Yemen shortly after the 1994 civil war, and today she's an assistant professor at Michigan State University. Al-Adimi translated 100 of these messages into English for an article in These Times called 100 Yemenis Speak Out Against the U.S.-Saudi War. Professor Al-Adimi, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us how this project got started.
So I was on a train to Chicago. I was invited to give a talk on Yemen, on the origins of the conflict, as well as what the U.S. Americans can do to prevent further escalation of this war at Loyola University, as well as at a rally in Chicago. And so on my way to the rally, I thought, you know, what more can I say that hasn't already been said? And I thought that Yemeni voices tend to be absent from these conversations, Yemenis in Yemen who are affected by this conflict daily. And so I tweeted out in Arabic. I usually tweet in English, but I tweeted out in Arabic, and I asked Yemenis in Yemen to describe in a sentence or in a word what their situation is like and to speak to an American audience. And by the time I arrived to Chicago, there were hundreds of responses. By the next, in 24 hours, there were over 700 responses. And so I translated some of those tweets in my presentation and in the rally. But then I thought, this is so much more than I expected, and these, you know, perspectives are so important to share with a broader audience. And so I've been a contributor to In These Times, and I spoke to my editor, and we decided to put a piece together. So this is where the 100 tweets, translated tweets, came about.
What were the themes that emerged in these tweets?
So some people spoke about personal loss. Two people who responded said that they had lost family members. One person had lost his wife and children in a Saudi-U.S. airstrike. Another person whom I know to have lost his daughter in 2015, also in a U.S.-Saudi airstrike, responded and just kind of spoke about the desperation of the situation in Yemen. But a lot of people were speaking about the humanitarian crisis. They, you know, mentioned the blockade. Many people used the word genocide because this is what they feel is being done to the people of Yemen. And not just, you know, the bombing and the bombing of the infrastructure and the collapse of the economy and the education and the health sectors, but also the blockade that's preventing aid and food and medicine to come in, and of course, people to leave. So a lot of people spoke about having, you know, very little hope for the future, even though all they wanted is to really just live in peace. And then a good majority of them were almost offended at the question. They said, we're not going to beg anyone to save us. This is not a call, a cry for help. We will support ourselves and we'll continue to defend ourselves. So there was this element of resilience and resistance to occupation that came up in those messages.
What are Yemenis asking for? What is it that they want, particularly off of that last statement you made about resilience, about sustainability, about being able to take care of themselves, essentially? I imagine that some of that reaction is also because this is a community that feels largely ignored.
Absolutely. I mean, we're talking about several countries, mostly wealthy countries, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar until last year, you know, Kuwait, Bahrain, Morocco, Egypt, all of these countries, you know, are working together to bombard a small country, the poorest country in the Middle East, that doesn't even have an air force and can't defend itself in any, you know, conceivable way. And of course, this coalition of countries is supported by the United States and the United Kingdom and France, and other countries sell weapons to it. And so I think a lot of people just, you know, feel like they're bombarded. A lot of people are profiting from this war, but Yemenis are left to kind of, you know, fend for themselves. Yemen, of course, is of strategic interest to these countries that are bombing Yemen. It controls Bab al-Mandab Strait, where about 4.8 million of barrels of oil travel daily. But Yemenis themselves are of no concern to these warring parties. We've seen hundreds of thousands of children already die of malnutrition and diseases. Diseases, preventable diseases like cholera and diphtheria, are killing children. Or, you know, the bombing campaigns, the violence that has left at least 60,000 people dead so far. And so they feel abandoned, and what more is there to do almost 4 years later other than to just continue to resist?
Do you think there's a sense of frustration? And I'm just really interested in the folks who were frustrated with the question. Is there a sense of frustration that everything that needs to be said has been said, and it's really the fault of the rest of the world for not paying attention?
Absolutely. People said that this is happening in clear view of the international community, and nobody has been doing anything to really prevent it. In fact, they've just kind of joined in and helped. And so many people said, you know, what more is there to see? You see our pictures, you know, and they really do post a lot of graphic photos in those messages, and they have been doing on Twitter, because they feel like, you know, many people have turned into journalists themselves to document the misery and the destruction that's been happening around them. So if it's a matter of evidence, the evidence has been collected. If it's a matter of, you know, the scale of the humanitarian crisis, well, there's no humanitarian crisis bigger than Yemen right now. The UN says it's the worst one on earth. And so people feel like if it's a matter of information, the information is out there, but nobody has been doing anything to stop it. They've just kind of either joined in or remained willfully ignorant about it.
And has there been any response from politicians to this project or your piece?
I've not heard from politicians, and I know there are a lot of private messages that I didn't get to reading just yet. There were dozens of them, but I just kind of wanted to hear from the average, you know, Yemeni civilian who's going through this war.
Shireen Aladimi is an assistant professor at Michigan State University. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Go to omahasteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today. This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, there goes the Spider-Man.
If you're a Marvel fan, you've seen Spider-Man on the screen before.
Who are you?
Spider-Man.
Who am I? I'm Spider-Man.
You're the Spiderling. Crime-fighting spider. You're Spider-Boy?
Spider-Man.
The web-slinging superhero and his alter ego, Peter Parker, have headlined 6 different movies since 2002. And this weekend, a new animated Spider-Man movie called Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse was number 1 at the box office. Except this time, viewers didn't turn out for Peter Parker.
My name is Miles Morales. I was bitten by a radioactive spider, and for like 2 days, I've been the one and only Spider-Man.
The character Miles Morales was first introduced in the pages of Marvel Comics back in 2011. And he's Afro-Latino, born to a Puerto Rican mother and an African-American father. And for an entire group of Marvel fans, Morales was the first time they actually saw themselves represented in a mainstream superhero comic. And one of those fans is Washington Post comics reporter David Betancourt, who joins me now to discuss the film. Hi, David.
Hi, Tanzina. How are you?
I'm well. So tell me what the Spider-Man movie meant for you and why.
It was a very unique experience. I've been reporting on Miles since his debut in 2011, from personal pieces to more in-depth pieces talking to his co-creator, Brian Michael Bendis. This is a character that's been extremely popular since his inception, but I did not think he would make it to the big screen this quickly. So to see them make it work so well, the movie has received glowing reviews all over, and the buzz on social media has been extremely high. It's been quite the unique experience watching all this unfold.
And that's a unique experience because not only do you write about comics, which, by the way, David, is an amazing job at The Washington Post, but also you felt like you saw yourself reflected on the screen. Is that right?
Of course. I am the son of a Puerto Rican father, and my mother is African-American. So when the news first hit, because the clickbaity kind of headline-grabbing thing about Miles when he debuted wasn't just that he was a new Spider-Man, but underneath the mask, he was not only a person of color, but biracial. That's literally – now, obviously, there are big-time African-American characters. You've got Black Panther, the Falcon, Marvel superheroes who've made it to the big screen in live action. But Miles was the first time where I literally – 150% could see myself in a character. So it's been quite the experience. And in our meetings, everyone was kind of just looking at me saying, you're going to write about this, right? And of course I am.
So tell us about Miles Morales for those who haven't seen the film yet. He's actually been around since 2011. So who is Miles?
Miles was the co-creation of writer Brian Michael Bendis and artist Sarah Pacelli. Back in 2011, Marvel Comics at the time had a They had two publishing lines. They had their main publishing line, which had been around since way back in the day. We're talking, you know, Spider-Man, X-Men, Black Panther back in the 60s when superhero comics really kind of started making a name for themselves. But Miles was a part at the time of a second publishing line Marvel had called Ultimate Comics. And this was a line where Marvel felt they could take more chances creatively with the types of stories they were telling and the type of heroes they were presenting. So in the Ultimate Universe, there was a younger Peter Parker who was kind of high school age, and he ends up dying in battle as Spider-Man. And it was kind of a big deal, but at the same time, because the real Spider-Man existed in the main line, it wasn't a catastrophic event that made fans really mad. But what came out of that was Marvel Comics taking the opportunity, and I spoke with Brian Michael Bendis about this years ago, to take the opportunity to give a Spider-Man that a little more accurately reflected the diversity of New York.
And I'm wondering, how central is Miles' Afro-Latino identity in the new film?
In the film, they do a great job. This is something I've been talking about a lot. This is a superhero film. At the end of the day, people are, you know, flocking to see this because they want to see him pull down the mask, shoot the webs, swing around, punch bad guys, and be Spider-Man. At the same time, you have to respect this thing that you've created that's bringing in all these diverse fans and give it its moment. There's only so much time we see Miles with both of his parents. His father is an African-American police officer. His mother is a Puerto Rican nurse. But in the brief few minutes moment when we see him together, where we see his father, you know, telling him to get ready for school and being a good dad, and his mom, you know, bombarding him with a million kisses and speaking to him in Spanish, they knew they had to have at least one moment like that where they not only addressed but embraced what it is that made Miles so special. And in a movie that at the end of the day has to be about superheroes and bad guys and good guys, I thought they executed it very well.
What about, you mentioned Miles' mom speaking to him in Spanish in the film. Again, she's a Puerto Rican nurse in the film. But that Spanish is not translated or subtitled. Tell us a little bit about that.
No, it's not. And it's kind of at least the first time I can remember where I'm watching a movie and a language, you know, watching a movie here in the States and a language other than English is spoken and there are no subtitles. It was kind of weird for me because this ended up being a big deal and kind of began trending a little bit. For me, it wasn't a big deal because I could understand what Rio was saying. His mom's name is Rio. But then I kind of realized, well, shoot, if you don't understand and the subtitles aren't there, it almost feels like maybe you're not left out, but just kind of have to take it in a different way and just kind of look at what they're doing, maybe try and figure out what they're saying. I thought that that was a very bold move to kind of say, hey, this is a movie with a Latino character. They speak Spanish, and you know, just follow along and enjoy the ride.
And how authentic do you think the writers are and the voiceover was to this character?
I think they did a pretty good job. I had initial concerns when the actor who was cast to voice Miles was not Afro-Latino, Shameik Moore. He's African-American, I believe, of some Jamaican descent in his family. So a little Caribbean in there, but not a native Spanish speaker or anything in any way. That was kind of... I initially had a lot of reservations about this movie. I ended up being blown away, but this is kind of a live action era. We've got these live action Black Panthers, Avengers movie making billions of dollars literally at the box office. And I thought for them to throw Miles out there, but animated at first, it didn't seem so great to me. But when I took a look and saw the movie and then see the different things they did. And a part of that was the cast. Yeah, Miles wasn't cast as an Afro-Latino, but they went out and got Luna Lora Valdez from New York Undercover to be his mom. So there were efforts there to bring authentic voices where they thought they needed to be.
And do you think they achieved in terms of getting the film right as an animated film versus a live action?
I think with an animated film, you can take a few more chances. This is a very bold storyline, multiple spider people from different spider verses. I don't think you could take that kind of chance in live action, but they seem to have exceeded with what they wanted to do because it looks like this is going to be a big hit that's going to spawn some sequels.
I was going to say, and do you think those sequels might be live action or animated? We've got about 15 seconds.
There's a hint. You know, Donald Glover plays Miles Morales' uncle in a live action movie, so Miles has been hinted at. We'll have to wait and see.
David Betancourt is a reporter focusing on comic book culture for The Washington Post. David, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to tweet us, I'm at Tanzina Vega. We're at The Takeaway. You can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.